Midnight is from the soundboard, hosted and produced by some guy named Reggie Johnson. Never liked him anyway. Anyway, it's now 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Listen to sponsored community radio since 1960. Stay tuned.
Coming up, Dr. Spencer Sunshine discusses breaches and fissures, the Capitol siege, and the next phase of far-right terror. Paul Laurence Dunbar was writing during the 1800s, a turbulent period in U.S. race relations. While slavery had ended, there was in the South a major backlash against African-American social and economic advancement, and lynching was a common form of terrorism. In the North, too, African Americans were denied equal opportunities in employment, education, and housing. Affected by these conditions, Dunbar wrote We Wear the Mask, a metaphor for social performance that African Americans would often put on to avoid negative consequences associated with telling the truth about their experiences with racial injustice or their feelings about it. Maya Angelou adopted the 1896 poem by Paul Laurence Dunbar, We Wear the Mask, in the following spoken word poem.
So, I wrote a poem for a woman who got on the bus in New York City, and she used to just laugh. The bus stopped, she'd laugh. If it picked up somebody, she'd laugh. If it missed them, I looked at her and I thought, that woman is not laughing. She's simply extending her lips and making a sound. That's that survival apparatus. Laugh when you aren't itch when you don't itch. Mm. So she could keep my people alive. Mm. So I wrote a poem for her. I use it with Paul Laurence Dunbar's poem, Mask, and my own poem for old black men. This is it. When I think about myself, I almost laugh myself to death. My life has been one great big joke. A dance that's walked, a song that spoke. I laugh so hard, I nearly choke when I think about myself. See, 70 years in these folks' world, the child I worked for calls me girl. And I say, yes, ma'am, for working's sake. I'm too proud to bend, too poor to break. I laugh so hard, my stomach ache when I think about myself. My folks can make me split my side. I laugh so hard I nearly died. The tales they tell sound just like lying. They grow the fruit, but eat them. I laugh so hard I start to cry when I think about myself and the little children. But then we wear the mask. It grins and lies. It shades our chits, our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts, we smile and mouth myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see while we wear the mask. We smile, but oh my God, our tears to thee from tortured souls arise. And we sing, but oh, the clay is vile beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world think otherwise. We wear the mask. My fathers sit on benches Their flesh count every plank. The slats leave dents of darkness deep in their withered flank, and they knock like broken candles, all waxed and burnt profound. They said, but sugar, it was our submission that made your world go round. They laughed to shield their crying. They shuffled their dreams. They stepped and fetched a country and wrote the blues in screams. I understand their meaning. It could and did derive from living on the ledge of death. They kept my race alive by wearing the mask.
Wearing the mask? Wearing the...
That's my people. That's my people. What? Look at the people I come from. That's love, kids. It's not indulgence. It's not sentimentality. It's not mush. That's love. Yes, ma'am.
Shereba.
Doctor, I'm just overwhelmed. We both heard Mr. Joel Osteen talking about people and how we do each other. And what was your interpretation of that, Doctor?
Well, it's true. We sometimes think we can be better than another person. The truth is, no human being can be more human than another human being. You can be younger and prettier and finer and richer, but you can't be more human. And to try to denigrate, to bring somebody down, why? Each time you do that, you're going down. In order to keep a person down, you got to be down there with him. Yeah. So the best say is, I liberate you from my ignorance. Bring peace in your heart whenever you go anywhere. Just decide, I'm taking peace. I'm not going to wait till I get there to make it. You understand? It's my prayer for you, and I thank you for your love.
From Maya Angelou's adaptation of Paul Laurence Dunbar's poem, We Wear the Mask, written in 1896, to Sweet Honey in the Rock, with our message in the wake of the white supremacist-inspired and white nationalist-led insurrection of January 6, 2021, those who believe in freedom will not rest until it comes.
We'll believe in freedom cannot rest. You believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We'll believe in freedom, cannot rest. Hear me talking to you. We'll believe in freedom. If you like it, we who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. The older I get, the better I know that the secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. Cause to me, young people come first. They have the courage when we fail.
We here believe in freedom.
We believe in freedom.
We're joined by Dr. Spencer Sunshine, researcher, writer, activist, and political consultant, to discuss the MAGA siege on the Capitol on January 6th, what led up to it, and what to expect from the far-right as we transition into Joe Biden's presidency regarding far-right movements.
In 1990, Spencer co-founded an anti-racist youth group in Metro Atlanta, Georgia, to combat the influence of the Nazi skinhead movement. Since 2005, he has written extensively about the U.S. far right, which includes post-war fascism, the Patriot militia movement, as well as anti-Semitic currents on the right. Sunshine was present at the armed takeover of Oregon's National Wildlife Refuge in January 2016. In August 2017, he was part of the counter demonstration against the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and was in the crowd during the car attack, which killed Heather Heyer and injured about 30 others. I wanted to begin by January 6th, the siege at the Capitol. For many, as it's being characterized in mass media, it marked the culmination of Trump's years-long quest to cultivate a fiercely loyal base that would do anything by him playing on their fears and resentments as he lured them into believing his incessant lies about the sinister motives of government election fraud and his own conduct. Is that your take on who the essential leaders, groupings were that came to the Capitol? Are they just passive dupes of the president's lies, who were and are really the primary movers in the siege of the Capitol January 6th?
There didn't seem to be a really important role played by organized groups that we would normally think of at these clashes we've seen in the last few years. Didn't seem like the Proud Boys or any particular militia group, although they were there, was like in a vanguard role in doing this. It does seem like it was his base. His base is broad and deep with 75 or something million people. They don't all believe that there's a cabal of satanic pedophiles that the Democratic Party is deeply involved in. But some of them do. Those are the people who showed up. They were actually a little more moderate and a little more mainstream than some of the people we've seen at the other clashes, for example, at Charlottesville, which was almost all white supremacists. These were people who had been whipped up, I think all of them, into these conspiracy theories, or they wouldn't have come to the protest. Did he feed them these conspiracy theories? Absolutely. But there are plenty of right-wing conspiracy theories that floated around our country for hundreds of years. But he fused them together in a group, and they might have been the bullet, but he was the gun that created this specific incident.
What can you tell us of the emergence of the alt-right group that have a formative role and now have seemed to, if nothing else, coasting off of an event that most people shudder at, but they revel in, and if anything now insist that they are going to promote by being present in various state capitals and the nation's capital to exploit? So who are some of the most prominent figures in this, and what do we know of them?
This isn't really an alt-right event. The alt-right preceded Trump. Richard Spencer had created a blog under that name as far back as 2010, during the first Obama presidency. It was around 2014, then it really got going. It's interesting that this event is a lot like Charlottesville in the sense that immediately after Charlottesville, the fascists thought that it was a great success. They went home and bragged, you know, about how wonderful that was. And then in the coming month, realized what kind of blowback was going to happen to them. Like, they got shunned from the mainstream connections they had were shut off. And so we're seeing the same thing. Looks like it's already happening to people who participated in this action. They think clearly it's a wonderful and great thing. And now as the FBI is coming to their doors, as they're being deplatformed across the board, people are losing their jobs. Even the other Republicans are turning against them. It has the same sort of dynamic that Charlottesville did, but for more mainstream Trumpists than participated in the Charlottesville demonstrations.
Is there a prominence that the QAnon conspiracy theorists played, that the Proud Boys or the Boogaloo Boys, which are the names that have been brought to the fore, certainly by the media, but were they advocates for this storming, this insurrectionist effort?
QAnon people were the main players in this. Groups like the Proud Boys and the militias were there, but I don't think that they were real prominent in it. It does seem like more like the just a sort of generalized hardcore base of the Trumpists who were really into the conspiracy theories and his more unhinged tweets and such. So QAnon for sure, because they're so driven by conspiracy theories, and other people who just had convinced themselves that Trump hadn't lost and it was a big scandal that Biden was pulling over their eyes. And there doesn't seem really to be a center to it. It's not like other events where there's clearly one group driving it.
What do you think is the glue that binds these groups, and what seeped into the consciousness, this kind of mass psychology, if you will, of fascism? How are we still to understand what brought these people there beyond the promotion of Trump and merely saying account for the vote? Is it white supremacy that's the thread that strings all of these groups together and all of these people?
The unifying factor truly is Trump. Trump has brought together all kinds of disparate parts of the far right that normally don't work with each other. We even saw that at the demonstration before this one in D.C. We saw white nationalist leaders showing up with other Trumpists, which hadn't happened, and really since Charlottesville, being very open. We saw that at this demonstration, too. Not that most of the crowd was, or even a huge percentage, but they were there with flags, and some well-known figures were there. But I think it's too reductive to say it's just white supremacy or race. Trump is a sort of all-purpose authoritarian. I think there's a lot of things that get mixed together. There's a lot of conspiracy theories that are linked in with anti-Semitism to a greater or lesser degree. It's a conservative authoritarianism that was able to appeal to a broad group of right-wingers. And even some people who probably didn't see themselves, at least before Trump, as on the right. You know, he was able to draw a lot of people who are apolitical or perhaps left-leaning beforehand into his fold.
You mentioned a backlash and pulling away by some people. Does this mean that a more hardcore group is now going to take a harder stance in some of these demonstrations?
Pretty much across the board, people believe so. There was in Eugene, Oregon, pretty intense clashes between Proud Boys and other groups. I think the Proud Boys are still driving these demonstrations on the West Coast, where they're the strongest. It's going to be a very volatile time. I think everybody who watches this stuff is very worried. There's pretty much consensus, I think, that some of the activists now who are still part of this Trumpist coalition, in particular the ones who started to enter into conflicts with the police, are going to break off and head towards a more radical insurrectionist position, perhaps joining in with the neo-Nazi movement.
Since the demonstration prominent on the internet for some weeks now, there does seem to be a coalescence of the groups, the very disparate groups, from the militia groups to the conspiracy theorist groups to the Proud Boys and the Boogaloo Boys and Baked Alaska, and it's actually the name of an organization. So was the glue that bound, if it was Trump, what was the expression of Trump? What was the ideology that is at the core and the motivational factor? I mean, what is some of the root that created these groups? It's still in my mind an issue of white supremacy and white nationalism. Your thoughts?
Trump offered a bellicose nationalism that wasn't a part of liberalism. He did not believe in liberal democracy, but he used all the symbols of American liberal democracy so people could see, who thought of themselves as patriots or nationalists, could act in ways that were actually against at least the best values of the United States while convincing themselves that they were upholding these values. The United States has a long history of white nationalism. White nationalism and white supremacy is a part of this, although it's not the explicit manifestations of it, and I think that's really important. Very few of these people, I'm sure, thought of themselves as avowed white nationalists, but most of them didn't, and I think even Trump, most of his followers don't. It's watered down just enough that it's palatable to them. And I mean, it is all the essential characteristics we think of white nationalism, of a sort of valorization of Western culture, a sort of denigration of black liberation movements and other movements for equality, an attempt to stop immigration, things that we generally associate with white nationalism and white supremacy. And, you know, there's long histories of deep misogyny in our country and conspiracy theories, anti-Semitic or otherwise, and various kinds of demonizing of others, of LGBTQ people and of Muslims. And he played into all of these, you know, deep traditions. Trump was often compared to Andrew Jackson. I think Jackson was his favorite president, and there are pretty close parallels between Jackson, who was one of the main figures in expanding the Native American genocide and having a kind of populist appeal to working people. And those movements run all through the 18 and 1900s, you know, various waves of the Klan in the 1860s and 1920s and 1960s, Father Coughlin and various fascist movements in the 30s, the John Birch Society, and the big waves of segregationism. So these are all very American movements, and he sort of tapped into that, a constant thread that runs through American history and is part of the American political psyche, you know.
So what is the prognosis? Biden comes in. Trump is still around, still doing something. I'm not sure what he's going to be doing, but he's not disappearing. How does the chemistry change, or does it change, between these alt-right groups and Trump?
I'm a minority amongst the people who watch this stuff. Most of them think that this kind of Trumpist coalition or these activated far-right groups are going to continue for several years. I think it might continue about a year before it fizzles out. Some of them who are now still under the Trumpist GOP banner are going to break off and become more anti-system, ones who are already gaining conflicts with police. I believe there will be a fight inside of the Republican Party that the non-Trumpist elements are going to try to take it back, since the Trumpists did not win the election and, you know, embarrassed themselves to the rest of Congress and to many people outside of their believers. The question is, what's going to happen without Trump? Because Trump has been such a unifying vehicle for them. If Trump continues to act like a political figure, that coalition in particular is much more likely to hold together. If he keeps barnstorming around the country, I was going to say keep tweeting, but he is now off Twitter, and I'm not sure they're going to allow him back on another account. He would need to find some other similar platform. It would be kind of funny to see Trump on Parler, which is the far-right alternative to Twitter, a step or two down for him. Without a central unifying figure, the groups might start to break up more like they were before. The movement that culminated in Trump in 2016, or the Trumpist coalition, really started back in 2008, 2009 with Obama's election. That's when we saw a new wave of the Patriot Movement. That's when groups like the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters formed. The Tea Party formed too, which was really the first mass movement of the far right that held public rallies. Like, the far right in the United States generally eschews protests and rallies. So that's kind of a left-wing thing until the Tea Party. And even though the Tea Party itself kind of fizzled out, all that energy went into other projects. Before Trump, we were noticing huge expansions in new media platforms that had millions and millions of followers were trying to, you know, get the left to pay attention to this stuff. People were like, oh, that's a distraction from the real issue. You know, people don't realize how much background there was to build to the moment of Trump. And so even if these things, the far right, fade after Trump, it will probably decrease to the level it was before, which is actually fairly big, and in fact bigger than people thought.
And on January 6th, the general pretext were the false claims of voter fraud that presumably brought people in talking about vote counting. Is that your understanding of really what the actual storming of the Capitol was about? Or was this certainly much more of an insurrection orchestrated much more considerably and much more precisely by fascist elements within our government who manipulated and played off of this very malleable base? And then please also, if you can parse out for us the role of the Republican Party, since it certainly wasn't just Trump, but Trump has been aided and abetted and promoted policy-wise for his entire administration by all of the Republicans, and whether or not this is really part of a maneuver that has developed towards fascism. And that was what the insurrection was really about.
obviously the demonstration or the rally was to protest the supposed stolen election. I mean, that's clear. But also, obviously, there had to be a riled up base that had been fed all these, you know, conspiracy theories and lies for a long time, or they wouldn't have believed this and they wouldn't have attended this and they wouldn't have had taken the actions they did. Trump sent them to the Capitol. He could have changed this. They went to a rally, you know, elsewhere first that Trump spoke at. He could have said, oh, go home now or go somewhere else. And he did not do that. I can't say with any certainty what happened when people got there. I mean, obviously, it seems very strange that there wasn't enough security and police there. A very wealthy country that pours tons of money into the security infrastructure, especially for its federal buildings. So I'm flabbergasted about what happened, but I don't have any inside information or knowledge. You know, I know what everyone else does from watching the news. Clearly, there's already started investigations into this, and heads have already rolled, whether they're token removals or not, you know, to fall guys or not, who are in charge of security at the Capitol. About a quarter of the elected officials, I think, in the Republican Party are pretty hardcore Trumpists, although the rest of them have gone along with this with very few exceptions and aided and abetted him. I think, you know, most of those are ready to abandon him and jump off the train. We're already seeing resignations of even people like Betty DeVos, who's already jumped ship. And so all those people are guilty, but Trump is a driving vehicle. But I don't think it was a coup attempt or anything, because people did occupy the Capitol, and that would have been the time for Trump to declare himself dictator or something, right? Also, once people got in the Capitol, they didn't seem to know what to do. A few people were storming offices, and there's some pretty crazy video of them trying to force their way into inner parts of the building. But most of them just wandered around and took selfies. Clearly, there were some people who were saying in the run-up to it, we're going to storm the Capitol. As in any demonstration, there's more militant elements. Assumably, these are people who got into the building first, but there didn't really seem to be a plan. I think it's more like they took advantage of an opportunity. You know, they saw that they could do this, and, you know, maybe some people pushed first for whatever reason. And I would hang back on people can speculate, but on making a decision about this, they were able to gain entry. I just don't see how the Republican Party would have benefited from this. And if they did plan it, why didn't they have a plan to enact it once their followers were inside? To me, that's the real question. If this was premeditated, then why wasn't they did get in? There should have been a next step, and there wasn't. So, but we will see after their investigations into this.
Whether we look at the right media, such as the Sean Hannitys, and we look at the Hawleys, and we look at the Ted Cruzes and stuff, certainly they have not in any way repudiated things. Lindsey Graham has begged and pleaded not to commence an impeachment. Allegedly, that creates more divisions. There clearly is an unrecanted group that is knowingly and consciously holding on and wants to hold on to and nurture this base, and it would seem use them as the shock troops of whatever political plans they have. And clearly there's financing going on from the higher rungs of Capitol. So it's not just Trump, but it is a concerted group of people that feel that they can use this. And then there are the groups and some of the leaderships that it seems to me do form the basis for a brown shirt movement that can live well with fascists. Do you disagree with that? Or
I agree that a certain part of the Republican Party are anti-democratic authoritarians. The mm-hmm. longstanding influence of the Christian right, who are a purely authoritarian movement, show this in their long influence into Congress. You know, what Trump used was this historic right-wing demagogue style. There's a lot of comparisons to Hitler or Mussolini or even Franco. It's this almost exaggerated, ridiculous style. It's a style that's been around a long time, and it really motivates a certain kind of person. It motivates them to action. The lies, the buffoonery, all of the things that he did are part of a playbook. And I think other Republicans saw that was a useful strategy. They could gain a lot of political support using that, probably have warmed up to it because they see that it's an effective vehicle. But there's always been authoritarians in the Congress. Usually they don't reach the presidency to the extent that Trump has. And I don't know. I mean, clearly they want to keep there are more people in the Republican base who believe in this sort of anti-democratic, socially conservative political perspective than there are in the elected officials. Some of the elected officials want to hold on to that base, and they're sure that they can hold on to it past this point. And they think the takeover, even though, you know, the breach of the Capitol is going to plays very poorly with everyone else, as long as, like Trump, they're just playing to that base, they can ignore it. And I think that's some of the refusal to apologize or refusal to think that anything went wrong. I don't think they can really hang on to power, though. I don't think they're going to be able to control the party during the Biden administration. But as long as they can control being reelected, they can be a prominent minority faction in the GOP.
Who are the people who are cheering their own that are not necessarily in these movements? How do they look upon what they're doing now? People who are not part of these groups, but maybe looking at these groups from some leadership, what do they think of what just went on and what the alt-right movement is doing and going forward?
I mean, that's a good question. I haven't seen, you know, I think you'd have to poll people to get that, the answer to that. I'm sure some people are alienated from it. This couldn't have played with, you know, half of Americans who voted, more or less, voted for the Republicans, and they're not all dyed-in-the-wool Trumpists. Some of them are just conservatives. Some of them are like, I'll never vote for a Democrat. Some of them just think Trump's antics are funny, aren't disturbing to them in other ways, and they're largely a white and somewhat older base. They just don't care about things that happen to people who aren't like them. I mean, let's just face it, a lot of Americans are like that. They're like, I got mine. It couldn't have helped them across the board with the base. I assume with the Trumpists, most of them are really into it. They see that it's a success, but I think that's a bit of an open question without actually getting some kind of data on it. It's hard to speculate on these.
Spencer, I know that you were in Charlottesville. You've formed groups that have looked at and countered the influence and responded to the likes of skinheads, etc. So I'm interested in hearing your thoughts. The roots of this kind of contemporary, particularly many of the younger people, how they came into this and what their aspiration is. Certainly we see, is it really about maintaining white skin privilege? We do have some of the older groups like the John Birch Society, who I know has continued to finance and propel forward the militia group. So people should be clear that we do have actual Klan chapters in Long Island, where we live, etc., in New York. So they are still there, but some of these newer groups, indeed, even groups like the Proud Boys, who have a Latinx leader, I'm still trying to grapple with whether it is the issue of white skin privilege, if it is the issue of supremacy, was it also the prevalence of the kind of universal cry for racial justice this summer, spurred on by Black Lives Matter, that also provoked and triggered what seems to be not only an exponential growth in these organizations, but some unity, some coming together.
First, the alt-right was able to tap into a much younger audience than right-wing movements have in a long time. Till recently, when people thought of like youth, high school students, college students, people in their early 20s being politically involved, they're almost always on the left. Now that's clearly no longer the case. So it wasn't unique that the alt-right was able to tap into youth and politicize them, you know, in mass. But it hasn't happened so often in recent history. Really, the Nazi skinheads in the 80s are probably the last time there was a real pool of people like that. And then maybe before that, Goldwater actually mobilized a lot of young people. So that's the first thing. The second, a lot of people are trying to get their minds around the Proud Boys. There's two ways I try to describe it. There's a lot of groups like the Proud Boys. They look, feel, and smell like white supremacists, but they're multiracial. Sometimes they have gay men and Jews. Although for all three things, it's a very, very small percentage of people. I want to stress that they are allowed in, but it's a tiny amount of people. You just don't find very many of them. Not like any group would do. They're put in front. It's good PR to be like, we're not white supremacists. Here's a person of color who's in our group. There's two ways you can think about that. One is throughout Latin America, especially in the 70s and 80s, they were very right-wing movements that were often Christian supremacists, that were deeply anti-communist, often backed a lot of, you know, juntas and other kinds of dictators. They would murder their opponents. They were against movements for social equality, often against in particular indigenous movements, too. But they weren't like some kind of racial purist. That kind of politics is very similar to groups like the Proud Boys have. And in fact, Enrique Tarrio, I believe, comes from that background. These are often like
right,
Cuban anti-communists.
Right, who's the titular head of the Proud Boys, we should say.
Yes, and there are other people like that who come from that background, who come from anti-communist families from Latin America. And the groups like the Proud Boys actually finally give them a way to get involved. Because they couldn't join a pure white supremacist group, and they wanted a militant group where they could go brawl in the streets. But they were extremely conservative and driven in particular by their opposition to liberation movements, especially like feminist movements and racial liberation movements, and driven by their opposition to the left, Black Lives Matter. They mobilized against that before they were really mobilized against feminists. This is a lot of what helped create the alt-right, was Gamergate, which is an anti-feminist, explicitly anti-feminist movement. You know, this is the whole anti-Antifa thing. It's really like a regurgitation of 1950s conspiracy theories about communists. They literally just switched the communists to Antifa. The other way to think about it is to, a lot of people, it's been argued, is that in the old days, before the civil rights movement, people thought of race as a very, you know, cut and dry, often biological sort of line. But the civil rights movement, that became verboten for it to be said or to be backed up in American society, right, until recently. And so what a lot of people who wanted to keep a sort of a racialized perspective did is moved it from biology to culture. They said, it's not about being white. It's about, you know, Western culture. It's about what are essentially the values of the white middle class, the perspectives of it, its politics. They did allow a number of people of color to be part of that as long as they embraced that across the board. This allowed them to dodge previous accusations of racism by being a little more flexible, but by keeping all of the main pillars that they kept before. And this is why you hear, for example, the Proud Boys go on and on about Western civilization. But they hold the banner high, and it's a sort of cultural way to express what before would have been white supremacy, and now it's a little an open white supremacy, an all-white white supremacy. And now it's a little more loose, but it's essentially the same things and expressed in a cultural way instead of a purely openly racial way. So those are the two ways I would try to explain what a lot of these other groups like Proud Boys, and there's a number of similar other groups, and to some extent even the militias, are about, and that's there is a difference between them and the explicitly all-white groups who say, yes, I'm a neo-Nazi, yes, I'm a fascist. Because yes, the Proud Boys will say, no, we're not fascists. The militias will say, no, we're not white supremacists. Whereas other groups will absolutely cop to it, and there is a difference between the two.
This is Building Bridges, and we're speaking with Dr. Spencer Sunshine. Every day there have been demonstrations by armed forces. There was a Patriot rally which had been posted on United Kentucky. It was billed as the biggest Patriot rally the state of Kentucky has ever seen. As it turned out, there were about 100 protesters, many of them armed, who came to the Kentucky Capitol. The question really is, how dangerous is this? Are we really on the precipice in some ways of a civil war? And what do these people, how do you assess what they want, or is that an unfair question since we have to go almost group by group to talk about it? I mean, there's all this generality about we're sick and tired of what this what's happening to this country. What do you think that means? Is there any kind of common purpose or understanding in these various groups who we'll loosely categorize as being part of the alt-right?
They want a dramatically different society, one that's based on a kind of traditional, fairly authoritarian, fairly anti-democratic structure. They want to roll back feminism. They want to roll back rights gained by the Black Liberation Movement. They want to put LGBTQ people, and particularly trans people, back in the closet, force them back underground, kill them if necessary. They want strong leaders. They don't want a democracy. They don't want equality. They don't want a vote for everybody. They're happy to disenfranchise people. In a way, they want to return to how the United States was earlier. This is why the militias always praise the early, almost often pre-revolutionary structures, things like the committees of correspondence and stuff, because some of these structures didn't grant and weren't interested in real equality and democracy. Some Some of them were openly theocratic, and they didn't have to answer to the federal government. I don't think we're on the precipice of a civil war. I actually think we passed that point. Trump has said that he will allow a transition of power, and I think if we were going to come to the point of a civil war, he would have declared himself dictator on the 6th, or if not, said that he will not transition power. And I think with him backing off, there's not enough. He is their unifying agent, and he would be the catalyst. He is not going to do that. He's made it clear. He's let the opportunity pass. And so I am afraid, and others are afraid, that a chunk of this movement will break off into perhaps acts of terrorism, into other kinds of armed attacks, because of their frustration of not being able to have the sort of mainstream political access they didn't. And that is a very real possibility, especially for the next year or two, that they will see no more avenue to express their politics in a non-murderous way. Even the militias, which have been rallying in very visible ways in the United States since the 90s, very rarely engage in actual armed violence. The people who do, who go do bombings or are threatening to kidnap the governor of Michigan, for example, are fringe people who are usually doing it on the side of the organized groups. But when the groups come out in public and wave guns around, I can't think of any incident where they've actually like opened fire or they've shown up as a group, take over in an organized way. Even what happened out in Mahir, the wildlife refuge in Oregon in 2016, led by the Bundy family, they didn't go as an armed militia. It wasn't a single group. It was one guy, who charismatic leader, who brought others with them. So when we see these armed formations show up in public, they're very theatrical. They go in public, they drill, and then they go home. Will some of these people break off and start, you know, to do more illegal, more dangerous things? Yes, some of them will. Will some of the Proud Boys move towards, you know, insurrectionist tactics or move into neo-Nazism as a piece of the group already did? When Bay Stick Man broke off and said he was forming a new group called the Proud Boys, yes, some of them will do that. I think that's the real danger for the next year or two, is a faction of the movement going to go embrace terrorism.
Yeah, what I'm concerned about is that one of the backlashes or legacies that come out of this is a constriction of our civil liberties, which people fall into in their chagrin over, of course, this tragedy, which amounted to 5 people losing their lives and was enormously frightening and was a direct confrontation with socio-democratic structure as conveyed, certainly by the Democratic Party. What is to be done? And isn't it a terrible mistake to fall into the trap of applauding the limitation in perpetuity of Trump from social media and making them the ultimate censors, other kind of laws potentially being passed that will restrict all of our rights to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of protest? It will invariably backlash on those of us on the left liberal movements who generally use these vehicles of expression much more so than the right has.
I completely agree with you that we do not need any new laws to be enacted in order to deal with these movements. There's plenty of laws on the books. The Patriot Act is still on the books. Anytime the FBI claims that they need new tools, just absolutely really ridiculous. They have plenty of money, they have plenty of agents, and they have more than enough laws to take care of true, dangerous, illegal actors, people who are stockpiling guns, people who have bomb plots, people are going to kidnap others. Fact is, the FBI is going to have to be the institution that's going to stop them. They have all the tools they need to do that already. As far as Trump being removed from social media, you and I are probably going to disagree about this. I think he should have been removed in 2015. We live in a capitalist society, and which is definitely one of Trump's things, that businesses didn't need to be mediated by the state. And if he violated this idea of there being terms of service and appropriate behavior on social media platforms, have always been there, and they should have removed him in 2015. They didn't want, Twitter in particular didn't want to do it. It was a huge boost to the platform about what its capabilities were. I'm sure they made a lot of money off of it. We already have, so I have two ways to discuss this. One, we already have outside things that are not allowed. It's not true that there are, these media platforms are freewheeling platforms where anything goes. Even Telegram, which is the most freewheeling of them, which is not based in the United States, has had to move back. The ISIS used to use it, and they've had to move back and not allow at least some aspects of open terrorism. there's always been limits, and it's a question of how far, where the limit is, and is it pulled back or is it let go? I think a lot of the things that Trump introduced never were allowed before him, and there was given, he actually expanded what was allowed further than it had been allowed before. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but he certainly did expand what was allowed in the mainstream. The other thing, I'm just not sure about this argument. For example, this argument was used a lot in the 80s, Holocaust deniers, when Holocaust denial really picked up in the U.S. Some Holocaust deniers had a tactic of taking ads out in student newspapers because either they took the ad out and they got a few followers and people wrote them for literature, or the ad was, or there was a big discussion over the ad in the paper. Or the ad was banned and they got a claim that they were, the defenders, the promoters of free speech. So as Deborah Lipschitz points out in her book, Denying the Holocaust, most of these ads violated rules that already existed in the student newspapers about content that demonizes, minority groups. They never should have accepted the ads in the first place. And eventually, after a period of doing this, most of the newspapers just decided de facto they just weren't going to take the ads. And they did it quietly. The Holocaust deniers simply got locked out by these papers. Now, you could say that was going to set a precedent against the left doing that, but it hasn't. Neo-Nazis used to not really be able to rally openly and perhaps to a almost illegal level. That Skokie kind of, the Skokie case in 1978 finally broke, but it was very difficult for them to use their legal rights in the United States. That didn't necessarily blow back on the left. There are two sides to the story, and I'm not involved in those arguments, so there's a very different perspective. But as somebody, I have a doctorate in sociology, when we look at how do you build attacks on minority groups, how do you build attacks on historically oppressed groups, how do you demonize them, and how do you motivate people? Well, one way to do that is to give, the actors who are doing that a platform to do it, and a big platform to do it. And one way to stop doing that is to take that platform away. Now, that might not be legal, but as a sociologist, I can tell you if you remove their resources, it is going to be harder for them to do that. So we have to consider both sides of this.
The other element that we hadn't discussed here was the permissiveness on the part of the policing apparatus. There's ample indication that in many instances, they removed barriers and facilitated the surge of the populace towards the Capitol, that there were selfies taken, and indeed many of the ideology is very pro-gun and pro-militia, indeed, even of the officer who was killed. His letters are very sympathetic of the right-wing manifestations of gun advocacy, etc. How do you look at the role of the police and their facilitation, and what is to be done about that element of the state itself that gave license to this activity? Or how do you characterize it? Insurrection, coup attempt, or still interested in how you actually characterize that surge on the Capitol?
It was a very odd combination of almost a protest, like almost just a festival, almost occupation, with other people really trying to invade. So to your question, that law enforcement more generally, not just local police, local and county police, but federal authorities as well, there is a massive discrepancy in how they treat different political factions in the United States. Finding a lever to force them into an even-handed dealing of different political factions would be very useful to progressive movements. The left attempted an armed takeover or an armed standoff. I think we all know this, like happened at the Bundy Ranch or at the Oregon takeover at the wildlife refuge. I think all of us, we would be crushed pretty quickly. In Oregon, they didn't touch them for like 30, 40 days. You could just drive right up there. You could order something on Amazon and have it delivered. The delivery trucks drove right up to the armed occupation of a federal building. I mean, it was insane. It is 100% true that local police were siding with, not all the way, they would crack down harder on Black Lives Matter and anti-fascist activists, and they give more leniency to the Proud Boys. I mean, it wasn't
well, and
quite...
also, though, they had telegraphed their violence for weeks in advance, so it wasn't just a kind of spontaneity based on predisposition or ideological sway. I mean, media had the violence, it was fermented in open and consciously from the security forces, etc. They stood down over this.
Yeah, in D.C. they did. I mean, I'm talking about the clashes that have gone on out west. The police have definitely sided with the Proud Boys and the militias. We definitely see a reluctance to enforce gun laws, you know, a reluctance to sometimes arrest people with open warrants who are very well known. So the right wing often has all this sort of hysterical language of civil war and going to be a revolution. It's pretty par for course for them, and many of their demonstrations are pretty tepid in relation to that. But the knowledge that it was going to be that big, and there was a real intense, there were flyers and stuff saying we're going to storm the Capitol. And if it had been a left-wing demonstration, you would have expected rows of police in front of the Capitol and buses to take everyone away, and the cops would all have plastic handcuffs. So I don't know what happened. These were federal police, I believe. So this is different in a way than some of the other conflicts in which local police, who are harder to control because the police, because they're controlled by local elements and not federalized. That's one of the problems for Black Lives Matter, is trying to get local. You have all the different agencies that are not necessarily linked together, and so you don't have a lever to change every single agency. Yeah, I mean, there were definitely videos of police seeming to wave people in or removing the barricades. It did seem like many of the police who were there were attempting to keep people out. There were a lot of scenes of really intense hand-to-hand fighting, you know, blood on the floors. The question is, again, did somebody higher up understaff the police intentionally? That's an open question. I don't have evidence one way or the other. It does seem ridiculous overall that, considering how large the demonstration was going to be and with all of the build-up to it, all of the threats of violence, that there weren't more law enforcement there. That is a definitely a two-sided treatment of groups on the different sides of the political spectrum.
So the takeaway now for those of us of good conscience, goodwill, who stand in opposition to white nationalism, to white supremacy, who understand that forces of QAnon are now actively in our government, which is a terribly frightening thought that such is tolerated and that there's enough of a base to have voted them in. And we do have 75 million votes for Trumpism, if not in its most extreme form, but certainly its practices and policies on some considerable level. What is it that you think should be the agenda of forces to begin to take more seriously and to thwart the advent of the alt-right and the alt-right revolutionists who certainly have come to the fore under and been given license under the Trump administration?
Well, that's definitely going to have to be a multi-pronged effort. The Democrats are going to have to win some of the conservatives to their side, the non-Trumpist conservatives, and act in a block with them. That is clearly Biden's strategy, and that's probably not a bad strategy for him to do. I think on the ground, there has been these clashes that have gone on between the Proud Boys and Antifa have gone on because larger elements of civil society and the larger liberal organizations have not called their base out to go confront them. And I think it's really time, when there's a militia rally with 100 people, for there to be 1,000 or 2,000 people counter-protesting them. It is a deeply demoralizing thing when that happens, and these groups tend to slink away when there's the same amount of people there and they can have a good fight. But when they're massively outnumbered, they tend not to have those demonstrations too often. There needs to be programs to get people out of these groups, people who have especially been in the more extreme groups, to essentially deprogram them, or some of it is just to hold their hand as they work through and work out of the place that they're in. This is particularly true for some of the more extreme groups. There are already groups set up to do this stuff, but they're deeply underfunded. We need people to change their mind. These 75 million people aren't going to go away. Okay, all of them gave consent to what's going on, but they don't believe. But the half or the quarter or however many of them believe, like, they're not going to go away. We want them to change their minds, and we need to give them an avenue in which they can do that. And you may disagree with me, but limit the reach of these platforms that just spread propaganda and lies and demonize others. We cannot treat lies and demonizing propaganda the same way we treat serious arguments and different people, you know, giving facts and having a disagreement. It's not, a lie is not just an opinion. People who can continuously and consistently lie and are consciously lie, we don't need to treat them as their legitimate figures, and we need to figure out a way, without adding new laws and without damaging everyone else's freedoms, to contain their reach and their influence.
No, I don't disagree with you at all. The First Amendment is never, it's an ultimate, it's nuanced in its application, and I speak as a lawyer as well, but I think it was important for you to explicitly say that, and it is troubling to hear people who rush, which there is certainly a tendency to do, since this is such a visceral response and activity in the whole experience of 4 years of Trump, plus for many of us is such that you tend to instantaneously applaud whatever limitations will be put on him. My tendency is to want him to be put up for trial first and to be very cautious about the efforts of the security state to categorically agree that the response to social and cultural issues is necessarily by more stringent laws, which will tend to conflate all of us and tend to ultimately restrict and have serious ramifications for freedom of assemblage, expression, and so on. I'm still looking at the manipulation of the use of the Espionage Act to indict publisher of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, mm-hmm. for revealing war crimes. I don't disagree. I think it was important to what you said, and I think it was a very helpful way of understanding things, and it's been very insightful and important to hear your very studied thoughts and opinions about a very frightening phenomena that has been nurtured and encouraged by a president who I personally do believe systemically is of the fascist mode.
He has been a toxic element to our country, and I think to an inspiration to toxic elements around the world for 4 years, and I think we can all agree to wish him a good riddance. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Dr. Spencer Sunshine, thank you for sharing your insights with us. For those of us who believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes.
Been struggling myself, don't need a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others to stand up and fight is the only way my struggles survive.
Is possible, and we are the ones to make it so.
Tune to Out FM on Tuesday, January 26th at 8 p.m. for a discussion of lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people in nonprofit labor unions with Desma Holcomb, a longtime labor organizer. She recounts the history of organizing efforts in AIDS nonprofits and sex shops. Holcomb described how a PATCO union leader, then employed at Washington's Whitman Walker AIDS Clinic, confronted management over an illegal management meeting.
And so, of course, the executive director called the guy in and tried to, Bill Taylor tried to fire him on the spot in, you know, big shouting match. And he basically said, I was fired by President Reagan. I'm not scared of you. You must be confusing me with someone who's afraid of you.
Tuned up. Out FM, Tuesday, January 26th at 8 p.m. on WBAI, New York.
I love New York.
We love New York.
We've been stuck inside our homes
while our everyday heroes have been working overtime.
For New York to reopen.
And stay open.
We all need to do our part.
And show that we care.
Look, man.
I wear a mask to protect you.
You wear a mask to protect me.
Let's all wear a mask.
To stop the spread of coronavirus.
And save lives.
When we show up in a mask,
we're showing up for each other.
Show your love for New York.
Because New York loves you.
Hey, this is Jackie.